Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 9th of October 2011. My name's TRP Watson, and this week I'm joined by Phil from the West End Whingers, Web Cowgirl, and Rev Stan. We're now going to talk about a production of One for the Road and Victoria Station, which has been done both at the Print Room, which is where Web Cowgirl saw it, and at the Young Vic in their Clare Auditorium, which is where I saw it this week. This is two plays. Victoria Station is really a conversation over a radio between a controller and a cab driver. The cab driver is a bit bewildered, and it's a kind of, I don't know, there's a certain air of longing and yearning about it, and the cab driver is very confused, not knowing quite where Victoria Station is, which is a bit odd for anybody who lives in London. You know, how can you not know where Victoria Station is? And the other play in it, One for the Road, is a very disturbing piece about essentially about an interrogator interrogating various members of a family. Only one of the members of the family talks, but there is a sense of all the nasty things that could happen to him. Now, I saw that play done by Harold Pinter himself some years ago, and it was rather powerful, the idea of this. You could very much see him as a mass murderer. This one was done by Kevin Doyle, who was much more, if you've ever seen Brazil, he was much more of a Michael Palin figure. If you've ever seen the film Brazil, where Michael Palin's an interrogator who does terrible things, but is actually rather kind and polite. Comes across as kind and polite in when you meet him socially, which is almost as how you're getting that difference between the horror and the reality. What do you think about this Web Cowgirl, this production?
I thought it was one of the best things I saw all year, actually. And it came right down to the fantastic writing. I was so absorbed watching it for both of these shows, what was going on stage, never knowing from one minute to the next what was going to happen. And then for both of these little playlets, there is this underlying question of what is going on here. There's like a mystery for you to solve. And I was completely absorbed in trying to figure out what had happened. I was really impressed. I had some quibbles about the degree of menace of the interrogator in One for the Road, because it almost, you know, I thought maybe he could have just cranked it up just a tiny bit, but the setting I saw it at was the Print Room, and you walked into this sort of low chamber lit by fluorescent lights by going down this very dark candlelit path, and it felt like you were going into another room. But having the fluorescent lights overhead gave it that banal sense of, you know, being in an office just anywhere. So when you start out with Victoria Station, you know, you think you've got maybe a cabbie who's just woken up from a nap, and then, you know, the controller who seems to be very, very mean, but the world that they're describing, the confusion of the cabbie makes it seem that maybe he's had a severe memory loss. Maybe he's been hit in the back of the head, except that it sounds like he's spent years driving around in his cab, never knowing where Victoria Station is. And then the controller, he can't find anybody else that works for him. And it starts to almost feel like there's been a nuclear holocaust and they're the last two people in the world. And even though it was just such a short little play, I really got involved emotionally with the two characters. Like, I didn't want the cabbie to be found out for whatever had happened to him. And then I started thinking, oh God, you know, are the zombies going to break into the room and carry the last two living people off? Which is actually, I thought that was really an amazing thing to do. And it must have only been, you know, 20 minutes for one for the road. And then suddenly the lights go down, the lights come back up. It's the same two people, but their situations are completely reversed. The cabbie is now the interrogator, or he's sort of a man who's hosting another man who's in the room, the former controller, and the controller is now this heavily broken man shuffling and limping his way into a room after something apparently very bad has happened to him. And Pinder just pulled me in completely. I thought it was just fantastic. I'm curious to hear how it was different, if at all, in terms of the atmosphere and stuff when you saw it at the Young Vic.
Well, we saw in the Clare. Now, the Clare is, I don't know if you know it, they have two smaller theatres, which is the Clare and the Maria. The Clare is
where they did Kursk?
No, that was a Maria. But okay. The Clare is a wood-lined, it's board-lined, you know, it's a sort of board-lined cube, essentially. And it's a slightly small thing. So we saw it all in the round, and it was all very brightly lit. So probably less atmospheric to start off with, because it's sort of very high. It's very open, that space. But was yours done in the round?
Yes, it was.
It's all still in the round. So we probably didn't get quite that atmosphere of the menace and the Dark Knight, although it went very dark when they did it. So you've got that. I think they spotlighted. They were spotlighting people. So just on the controller, just on the cab driver. When you're getting that across, and they also used light rather effectively. He would take the engine. He would take the car's headlights. The cab is represented by a broken an open engine and a couple of headlights or two thing. And he moved those around to spotlight people. So in the dark and the gloom. But we were in a situation where we could all see each other in there. It was a bit too, you know, possibly a bit too brightly lit, which was embarrassing for somebody whose phone kept going off, which is always annoying. Yours does sound slightly more atmospheric, but it was very, as you say, it was very touching, and it's remarkable how well those plays sort of went together, because they don't normally go together. I saw it, you know, I saw One for the Road in a double bill with another play. I think it might have been Ashes to Ashes. I'm not entirely certain, but when I first saw it, and again I saw Victoria Station, they did a sort of a Pinter Night done by Bill Bailey at the Theatre Royal Haymarket a couple of years ago, and they had lots of Pinter short plays, and that was one of them. So they're split up. So it was interesting bringing those two plays together, and sort of you have that switch over between sort of the person in control and the person not in control. And there's also that nice touch where instead of physical injuries, people had written things on the victims. Which was quite interesting, especially the young woman, the wife in One for the Road. She sort of has all sorts of expletives written all over her face and body instead of injury, you know, instead of showing injuries or blood or anything like that.
Yeah, I thought that was actually a really effective way of conveying somebody who had somebody else take control of her, the writing on her body. You know, of course the man's performance was very physical with the shaking, and then of course his difficulty speaking in the last act, the last scene. But you know, you only see her once, and I thought they did I mean, it was such a stripped down performance. I mean, you know, what was there? Like, you know, a table, some chairs, and a little bit of whiskey. And
yeah, there's always got to be whiskey.
Yeah.
It's a staple.
I thought it was just, yeah, he does always make you want to have a drink, you know. And actually, that's exactly what I did after the show, is I went and had a drink. Because you remember I was talking about, you know, going with a friend, and you're always, and the same thing for you, and you're always hoping that maybe they'll enjoy it. The guy that I took to see this with me, I've only taken him out to 3 or 4 shows, and this was a last-minute thing where the person I was going to go to was sick. And he walked out of it saying, "This is the best thing that you have ever taken me to. That was just fantastic." And I felt so happy that for once I'd gone to a play with someone who doesn't go see a lot of theater and actually gave them something that they were going to remember. So I thought this was a really winning evening. By the way, did you know that there's going to be a presentation of about 5 short Harold Pinter plays as part of the, I believe it's the Bite season at the Barbican. And this is actually going to be happening at Shoreditch Town Hall in from mid-November. They're going to do press conference, one for the road, precisely Mountain Language and New World Order, but it's being done as an immersive experience. I have to say, it might be a little terrifying.
Yeah, that sounds very interesting. I hadn't heard about that.
But if you like Pinter, then I would say that this this other show would really be one to see. And you know, I went to see. I think that Pinter is the, you know, best English playwright of the 20th century. And I've been trying to see every single play that he's ever written. And this doubleheader of shows that the Print Room and the Young Vic put on did, you know, only made me think that I was really on the right track with that.
We're going to talk now about a piece inspired by an article in The Guardian this week, which is The Joy of Walking Out of Top Girls. This is by writer Stuart Jeffries, who took along... who went with 3 other people to see Top Girls at the Trafalgar Studios. This is Max Stafford Clark's 2011 production of the play. He's produced this play every 10 years since he first did it in 1982. So there's been a 1991 and a 19 and a 2001 production. So we've already talked a little bit about this play and. What we did feel when we talked about it on the podcast that it was fairly difficult, especially that first part, the first bit, which is a dinner party with a large number of historical women all talking over each other. It can be very confusing, and I'm not too surprised that he decided that he couldn't take it anymore, and his friends couldn't take it anymore, and he walked out. Now, we've already talked about walking out of plays that I did with Rev Stan a while back, but I've got a couple of people who occasionally walk out of plays. We have Phil from the West End Whingers here, and we also have Webb Cowgirl. Now, why do you walk out of plays, Phil?
I mean, in a word, because we're bored or just not enjoying it. And I think the thing that one discovers once you start doing it is the sense of relief and the feeling that you haven't ruined a whole evening of your life. People think, well, you paid the money for the tickets. Why would you do that? I think, isn't it better to actually have part of your evening back than sit there for perhaps another hour, hour and a half, which you're not enjoying? Now, of course, you could argue, people do argue, well, the second half could be fabulous, which on one occasion where we were thinking of walking out was the wonderful world of Disassociate, where we had loathed the first half but actually found the second half quite interesting, because again, a bit like Top Girls, the second act is completely different from the first. So you can, you know, you can get unstuck occasionally, and in a way it is interesting that the piece happens to be written about Top Girls, because that is quite famous for being, you know, 2 very different sort of halves. But we've been doing it quite a bit recently. It's funny enough, the person really you should have here is Andrew, who does it much more than me. I sometimes stick it out. For instance, My City, the polyarchive play at the Almeida, I know that Andrew wanted to leave, but I sort of tricked him into coming back for the second act.
Yeah, I think we both did, actually.
Yeah,
I went there with you. I think I felt terribly guilty.
Yeah, being persuaded. It really didn't
get anywhere. Like that somebody left some money under his seat or something.
No, I left him holding my drink as I nipped to the loo, and then there was sort of no time for a decision to be made, and he was sort of dragged back in. And I do regret that, because the second act was worse. And but the thing was, the first act, and I think the same with The Veil, which Andrew also left, I stayed, is that the first act had sufficiently intrigued me to want me to see what was going to happen. In both cases, it was a mistake staying. We did walk out of Terrible Advice at the Menier last week, which I'm so glad we did, because many people have said to us the second half is even worse, and that really was dreadful. People around us were laughing at it. We weren't laughing at all. I thought it was crass, unfunny, and frankly quite boring.
Yeah, we have talked about this because I saw it a while back, and it was when I saw it, which was a very early preview. It was a very much a case of the person laughing loudest was actually the author, and we got the jokes. We got the jokes, but we got it a while after they did. But it was it was a bit of a shame. That, you know, it ought to have done better, that one. But I mean, it's the I have to say that I'm one of these people who's never walked out, or only once. And the time I walked out, and the time I walked out was The Mask of the Red Death. And really, what I should have done was read your article, the Western Windsor's article, on your review of The Mask of the Red Death, and pay attention to things, you know, like following the sounds. Because I spent an hour and a half on The Mask of Red Death not seeing anything. You know, almost literally walking in on a scene that was finishing, or getting there and just no one there, you know, no one's about, no one's there, you're missing, and I just felt I am missing absolutely everything. So I insisted on leaving in the end after an hour and a half, and they said, why don't you wait until the finale? The finale's great. And I thought, I'm going to miss that too, because I've missed everything else. And I left, and only to find out, of course, that they rounded you up for the finale. Made sure you saw it. And if you read between the lines on a lot of those reviews, everyone sort of says, well, I wandered around for an hour and didn't know what was going on and never saw anything, but the finale was fantastic. And even that's your West End Windsor's review was a bit like that. So I kind of regret not seeing that. But another reason for not going is I tend to go to the theatre on my own. And it is as you say, there's nothing worse. I've been one of the reasons I go to the theatre on my own, apart from I go to a lot of theatre and it's very difficult to schedule it, it's also that feeling if you go to a play where the person you go with isn't enjoying themselves, there is nothing worse than that feeling you get from them, the vibes you get from them. Now, Web Cowgirl, you've had feelings like this. Why do you feel you walk out of place?
Yes, that actually... that was part of the reason why I left Ragtime at the interval, despite the fact that this was the production at the Landor Theater in September, and I was told it was an amazingly well-sung, fantastic production in a very small space. I wasn't connecting with the show emotionally at all because of the way that it was written, and I thought the lyrics and the music were sort of banal and forgettable. I mean, not horrible, but then the quality of the music and the performances was very good. But the person sitting next to me that I brought with me was a very large man. He's about, 6'1", 230 pounds. His knees were splayed against the chairs in front of him. He was shifting constantly in his seat. I could tell he was really uncomfortable. And I decided at the interval that sort of the thing to do for the friendship was to propose that we just not go back and maybe just sit down and have a beer and enjoy the rest of our evening, because I felt like I was putting him through, a torture session in the cramped little theater. Now, if I had been completely entranced by the show, I would have been begging and pleading with him to stay with me. Instead, he was trying to be nice and say, oh, no, yeah, sure, no, we can come back. And I was like, I really think we should have pints instead. And I think he was relieved. So that was a situation where, you know, I felt in the interest of the friendship that making the move out was the way to go. But to be honest with you, for a lot of shows that I leave, I mean, aside from the shows where there's just this sense of panic and like, my God, it's so terrible. Will it ever end? And this was Fram. For Fram, one of the people that I took with me, and I organized a group of five people to go with this. I'm just happy they were still talking to me afterwards. But one of the people actually vaulted over his seat to get out the back of the National and just ran into the night. He didn't really say anything about it. He just left. But he said it was just a sense of panic to get away from the horror of the play. That's how I felt when I went to see A Woman Killed with Kindness. Just this, Jesus, are they ever going to let us get out of the play? And I watched some people who actually had the balls to walk over 10, 12 people to get out of the theater. And I thought, Jesus, what I wouldn't have given to have been sitting on the aisle instead of popped in the middle of a show. And we just couldn't leave. But when you're sitting there waiting for the interval because you want to get away from what's happening on stage so bad, you know, it's a really bad sign about, usually your mood's been ruined and it's almost impossible to recover from it. But for me, part of the reason, like, I do actually walk out of shows fairly frequently, by which I mean, like, maybe four or five times a year I'll leave at the interval and just never come back. But it's just, you know, my time is precious to me. And if I have 1.5 or 2 hours that I could get back in, you know, then I want to take that. And if I'm going to regret having spent that time watching a show that was a waste of my time, then I would so much rather sit and have a glass of wine and talk about anything, you know, especially if you're on the banks of the Thames and it's so pleasant outside. Why waste your life watching bad shows when, you know, there's the rest of your life to enjoy? And the only time I've actually stuck through things I seriously, seriously hated was when I was concerned about getting my review written up. But I don't want to be limited by that. When you see four or five shows a week, actually having 1.5 or 2 hours to, you know, say actually do writing or, you know, God forbid, get to bed before 11 o'clock or midnight is a blessing. So, you know, when I left the Vale, I spent £12 for my ticket. And I thought, you know, I feel like in terms of entertainment value, I've received my £12 worth. And it was going to start being a negative thing where I felt like maybe the theater needed to pay me to stay any longer.
Okay, there is a worry. I mean, one of the things I worry about, of course, is that because I tend to stay, it can get a bit embarrassing when suddenly things can disappear. I mean, I sometimes think I've got body odor issues because occasionally rows seem to empty around me. Only on Friday, I went to a play, and I can see why the people didn't come back after the interval to this play. It's a Fit and Proper People at the Soho Theatre, which is a bit odd, and I hope to talk about it more with if other people see it. But I was sitting at the sort of the end of a row, and the four people on the row didn't come back after the interval. As I say, I don't particularly blame them because it was a fairly odd piece, but it can be a bit embarrassing like that. I remember when the first time I met the Whingers, both Phil and Andrew, it was at a production of Third Person Singular, which I think you went to as well, Web Cowgirl, and you managed not to walk out of that one, but everybody else in my row did. So I was left up on the front row of the circle and the only person in my block of the front row of the circle. And I'd taken two friends there. And, of course, they had left at the interval. It's kind of an embarrassing thing when you get left behind. But, you could sort of understand why people do it. I mean, if you're not engaged in a play, yeah, you really shouldn't be there, because it's to a certain extent it's the play's fault, but it also, you know, there can be other issues going on.
So I wanted to say that I actually found Phil and Andrew's willingness to walk out of shows one of the things that really sold them to me as critics, because you have to go see a lot of shows really before you have the confidence to realize when your time's being wasted. And the West End Windsor's blog was one of the few places where I actually saw people who went to enough theater that they were willing to say when something was just rotten. And I may not feel the same way about shows as them, but I think it is a blessing to you as an audience member to actually feel that you can go and you can claim back those precious moments of your life. And I felt by reading their reviews that I wasn't alone in the fact that I often thought that going was better than staying.
I always wonder what would happen if a play was so bad, and this would never happen, but the whole audience left at the interval. What would happen? Or one person was left. They would presumably have to carry on with that one person. It would be awful for the cast, but it would be interesting. And I think that people should exercise their right. And I think it's catching on. There have been plays which I've gone back to after the interval reluctantly and seen that a lot of people have left and thinking, yeah, they probably made the right decision. People were walking out of the Vale at the interval, although I did go back. There were quite a few empty seats. I actually heard some people saying, we are leaving, aren't we, and walking out. And again, you know, I made a mistake by going back. But that's, you know, that's the risk you take. And I thought, well, I could sort of go back on Andrew's behalf in a way. So, but we do get criticised for it sometimes. And for instance, one of the worst things I've seen recently is Cool Hand Luke at the Aldwych, but we went to the press night, so we obviously couldn't walk out of that because we'd been given tickets. And critics are duty-bound to stay. You're not duty-bound to stay if you paid for your ticket. If you've been given a ticket, you have to stick it out. But I think Cool Hand Luke would have lost a lot of people at the interval. And we'd already had the one interesting scene, which is the egg scene. If that had been in the second act, people would stay for it if they'd bought their ticket, I think, because they haven't seen the key scene, which everybody's talking about. But unfortunately, it's in the first act. But it seems a bit cruel to give Cool Hand Luke a kicking, because it's had plenty of kicking. And again, one star in the Sunday Times today, so I think that's quite...
I have to say, I saw it this week, and that one. I can see why people are criticising it, but I thought the criticism is largely that it doesn't have Paul Newman in it. If it had Paul Newman in it, it would be a much better play. Or
play. Oh, yes, I would!
Yeah.
That wasn't the problem for me, because I didn't have a problem with
Mark Warren.
Yeah, I thought he was fine, actually. But
the play's not really up to much. But you do need, for the story, you need somebody who's got the massive charisma.
I think it was the way that it was done, actually.
Yeah. Right, we're now going to talk about another article that came in the Guardian. Fair play, who should gender equality be in theatre be mandatory, which is about whether or not women should be better represented. It comes from the problems that you have where you address the equality of women in theatre. Obviously, women, there are a lot of women who work in the theatre, but they're not necessarily in the major creative roles. So they're not necessarily the artistic directors, although we are seeing some prominent artistic directors being women. And it's very possible that the next artistic director of the National, it's almost going to be insisted that it's a woman by the sort of theatre, the theatre cognoscenti or whatever, the people who run the theatre may well insist on it being a woman next time it comes up, if there's a decent woman candidate, and so we are seeing a slight growth in that. But there's also the other thing of female directors, female writers, again, f- female writers are coming through, as are female directors. I think when I look at new plays, I seem to see an awful lot of new plays by women. I'm not sure if that means that I'm seeing sort of 20% of the new plays I'm seeing are by women. I just think that's a lot, or whether it is closer. I suspect it's closer to 40% of the plays I see are by women. I do see an awful lot of new plays every year. But it's also the thing of women are underrepresented on stage. There are lots of plays out there where there's only one or two women, where there's, you know, lots of plays also there's no women. In this article in The Guardian, they talk about, they mention Propeller, who Edward Hall's company Propeller, which of course is an all-male Shakespeare company. And that's a bit of a problem. That can be a bit of a problem, especially if he's getting money and he's sort of excluding half the sex. It doesn't seem to matter with Propeller. It doesn't seem to be that much of a controversy. Before I go into more of what I think, perhaps Rev Stan, if you'd like to say where you stand on this.
Yes, it's an issue in so much as there are fewer roles for women in the theatre. It's a problem in the film industry as well, and television as well. I have a film blog, and I've written about it in the last couple of months, actually, about the issue. But as a sort of someone who goes to the theatre a lot, I don't necessarily seek out plays that are written by women that have strong female leads. I'm attracted to go and see a play by the story, and that has to come first and foremost. A second point I'd like to make is that I don't think forcing the issue, that it is getting a lot better. As you say, there's a lot more there are a lot more female playwrights out there. We've got some very good female directors around at the moment, Thea Sharrock and Katie Mitchell, regardless of what you think of Katie Mitchell's work. And I've completely lost my point now. I don't think you can force these things. And I think the article implies that there should be sort of like, you know, there should be like forcing, theatres should be made to put women in the top roles, and maybe sort of, you know, do so many plays written by female playwrights. And I think forcing the issue is wrong. I think it should be based on talent. That isn't to say you can't foster it, but I think going down any road where it's, you know, where you have to have a certain percentage of female representation, and then the issue is wider as well, because I mean you could say similar things about ethnic minorities in the theatre as well. And it's interesting what you say about Ed Hall's Propeller. I don't have a problem with Propeller. I think because it is Shakespeare, and Shakespeare was traditionally performed by all men, and I think I actually quite like seeing Shakespeare performed by all men, because that's how it was intended. So I don't have a problem with that at all. Yes, it'd be good to see a few more good meatier roles, but it's the story and the talent that is the important thing.
Yeah, the thing about Shakespeare, of course, is as you say, he wrote. Although he wrote for, you know, his women's parts are often some of the better women's parts for women today. But they are, of course, written for women. They were written for male actors, although a lot of the male actors were female impersonator specialists. But there were one or two. I mean, think someone like Rosalind in As You Like It. You could easily see whoever played that could go on to play Prince Hal in Henry IV. It would be a very easy turnover. So you might get that sort of thing. You know, you might get somebody who was an up-and-coming young actor just to play Rosalind for a bit, and then he would go on to some of the other juvenile roles. He might play Romeo and Juliet, or as I say, Prince Hal, and so you could see that. And it's interesting actually that many of the major women's roles, you know, the really big meaty ones, are done by are done by male playwrights. I mean, you have things like Ibsen, and you've got Chekhov, magnificent roles in there. Although, of course, Chekhov was probably writing, if you look at the similarity between a lot of the roles and a lot of sort of the age range that he uses, is there are a lot of similarities between his big plays. And it's almost as if he's writing specifically for sort of four or five actresses in a company. I mean, he was very closely related to the company and wrote a lot of plays for them. So it's almost as if he's saying, well, I've got these four or five great actresses that I can use. I'm going to write roles for them. And you deliberately get some very powerful ones. But one of the problems I have is that you're not necessarily getting that kind of role for women. I mean, the thing I'm more interested in is seeing great roles for women in the way you see great roles for men. And it's almost as if you make it's the problem is that it's an issue as a sort of what if you're a sort of writing plays for white male heterosexuals, then you're not having to kick against any pricks. You're not having to sort of fight on any social issue necessarily. I mean, you might have a class issue in some cases, but you're just really dealing with, you know, straight relationships, uncomplicated relationships, uncomplicated by sort of gender politics or race politics or any other kind of politics. You're just dealing with that sort of power relationships, perhaps, and that seems to have produced an awful lot of sort of what you might call everyman roles, where any actor can fight them, any actor can go in and play them, and so you get a large number of those. And perhaps male writers are much more at home doing that kind of role. But whenever a woman has to do it, she's got to do. Whenever you sort of introduce a woman into it, and if you're making her powerful, you're making her powerful as a woman. And it's more about the way that society is built. You know, it's a very the best fit is a heterosexual male white thing, is, you know, the WASP type idea. That's still the dominant force in sort of Western theatre. It's still the dominant force in Western society. So if you want to write just pure story, where you're not having any political overtones, you're not having race or sex or gender politics, you're just doing the men, you're just doing the male relationships, you know, straight male relationships, and that's a pity. And it's more that the society has to change. We have to have a situation where we aren't bothered by that. And it's one of the interesting things about some people have done Shakespeare, where you suddenly get put a female into an odd role. We had Emma Pallant in The Globes As You Like It playing Jaques, which was a very lovely touch, I thought. You probably didn't see that, but a lot of people commented on how good she was. But we did also see a female Horatio in the 1603 Hamlet, which worked really quite well. I think there.
And didn't Catherine Hunter play King Lear?
Oh yeah, Catherine. And some years ago, I mean, about 10 years ago, Catherine Hunter played King Lear, and she was rather good at it. Mm. And of course, famously, Fiona Shaw played a very good Richard II. It must be 15 years ago now. She was particularly effective. And it is something that they can sort of slip into. And there's no question that a good woman can play it. Although it hasn't always worked. I saw Vanessa Redgrave doing a Tempest, which didn't quite work. And people talk more about Catherine Hunter's King Lear than her Richard III, which she did at the Globe a while back. But it is a pity that we can't see it, and it's always you always get the sort of the gender politics twist whenever you try to do it. You've got something like Top Girls, which is not seen as a good play, which I think it is, but it's seen as a sort of, you know, a feminist play. And if you ever get somebody like Aphra Behn's plays, now Aphra Behn was an average to good Restoration playwright. Now, we don't do Restoration comedy or Restoration plays that much. I mean, there's occasional Congreves, and sometimes people pretend that later playwrights like Sheridan or Farquhar or Goldsmith are Restoration playwrights, which they're not really. But Aphra Behn, major playwright, first professional woman playwright in England. She earned her living by the stage. She was an average to good one. Well, we don't do any restoration plays, really. And that means she gets neglected. And whenever she gets brought up, she's brought up as this great feminist icon, which she wasn't. She wasn't particularly a feminist. She was writing mainly like the men. You know, her plays don't have a massive insight into the role of women. The female roles are a little bit better. They're a little bit better understood. But we're not doing those plays anyway. So you sort of have to. She's weighed down by that weight of the, you know, the feminist expectation on her. You know,
well, let's do it. There's a very good example recently of Diane Viven Rose, which is an all-woman play, which I thought was absolutely superb. I don't feel that wasn't an overtly feminist play, if at all a feminist play. But I remember us talking about it off air about, and you thought it was a bit girly for you. So is that perhaps
that can certainly be a problem.
Take the sort of the gender politics out of it, are you then alienating the men?
Yeah, it's something I'm not really all that used to. I mean, it's something I think that if I'm going to be complimentary about myself and, you know, pretend I'm not sexist, it's that I felt that it was, with Di Viven Rose, it was sort of, yeah, the things I would be critical about are things that the women wouldn't have been critical about because they understood it. You know, I was bothered by some things, and I think that women were giving it a bit of a buy and praising it an awful lot, but there was just one or two little bits of it where I thought, well, I need that story better told, or I need that thing. You know, I was being a bit fussy about it, and people were perhaps giving it a little bit more of a buy because it was a girl play. And also, there's an awful lot of recognition when I was in it. There were, you know, women all around me getting things that I sort of got. You know, I could see where they were coming from, but they were getting it much more than I did. And it's not a problem so much, and especially as women go to the theatre, seem to go to theatre a bit more than men do, that isn't going to be a problem putting that kind of play forward. And I definitely hope that Di Viven Rose gets a bigger audience somewhere, because it certainly deserves to. I mean, quite apart from anything else, Amelia Bullmore's a very good writer as well as a very good actress, and it's always worth her stuff is always very well worth seeing. I hope it gets further viewed elsewhere. I was a little bit worried about the girliness of it, that the women got it more than the men, and that could cut you out of it. But that's really, that's a societal thing. That's because I'm not quite so, you know, because we don't mix in quite so much. You know, you're constantly fed the male version of society in the media, in everything. So you're more used to it when you see it. So when you see something which isn't, which is unapologetically by women for women, it is slightly, it's unfamiliar. I'm not going to say alienating, but it is certainly a little bit more unfamiliar, and you have to realise that you're not normally given this sort of thing.
Although I do know other men that have been to see it and really enjoyed it, so. Yeah. You can't sort of.
Oh well, no. I mean, I'm just, you know, I'm
not
probably,
saying you're on your own or anything.
I'm probably not a good enough example of manhood. I think perhaps I'm probably not in society enough. You know, I spend much of the time at home or watching theatre on my own.
To praise theatre above film. Particularly and TV, I think theatre is a lot better at having roles for older women, a lot better than the film. And I do feel sorry for actors that do most of their work in film and television, because there's a big gap in the age range. You've either got to be, you know, young, leggy, can wear short skirts and a bit of eye candy, or mumsy, and there's not a lot in between, and I think the theatre is a lot better at providing those sort of in between roles and sort of more variety of roles for women, but that isn't to say that it couldn't be a lot better.
You can find the podcast at AYULTP on Twitter. the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page on Facebook and on the web at ayu-londontheatre.org. Goodbye.